everyone, and welcome back to the Faculty of Horror, podcasting from the horrid halls of academia. I'm Alex West with
Andrea Subisati.
And I don't know about you, Andrea, but I am hungry.
So hungry.
And it was also very cold. I literally walked from the subway, about a 10-minute walk, against the freezing wind of Toronto right now, and staggered into the Rue Morgue Manor. So I'm very, very grateful for you taking me in this evening.
Oh, my pleasure.
It would be a shame should anything bad happen.
A pity should our ravenous hunger go wrong.
Ooh.
Woo.
And of course, while these facts are all very true, we are talking today about Antonia Bird's 1999 film, Ravenous.
That's right. It's February. It's Women in Horror Month. For better or for worse, Ravenous is one of the five films I always hear trotted out every single year, Women in Horror Month. Well, we don't need Women in Horror Month. I can think of five films that women directed in horror. Ravenous pops up in a lot of those, but hey, it's a great film.
It's a great film. It's one that, like, every couple months, one of you listeners will pop up with a, like, hey, what about Ravenous? So it's one that I saw years ago and I liked, and I've been meaning to revisit, and I'm so stoked that we did for this episode.
It's
a joy of a film. I almost feel like we don't deserve this film because it's such an oddball. And it was made by, you know, a subsidiary of a major studio, Fox 2000. And
yes.
What a strange little production history
complete
this has as well.
Clusterfuck of production, total bomb at the box office. But now, 20 years later, being reappreciated, I'd like to think. I found a lot of articles about this unsung gem. Another thing that came up in my research was a more recent film of the same name. Well, it's the same name if it's translated, but there is a zombie film called Ravenous, or known by its original title, Les Affamés. So I hope there's no confusion in our listeners about which one we're talking about. Had I remembered that film earlier, it might have been an interesting double bill, but whoops, I actually haven't seen it.
Neither have I, and honestly, this film gives us so much to chew on that I don't know if our recording computer could handle another 2.5 hour long episode.
Well, let's see how many cannibalism puns it can handle, because I'm full of those. So, without further amuse-bouche, the 1999, That's it. You've done it.
I'm kind of proud of him. He lasted like a good 5 minutes.
I'm sending you to California, Fort Spencer.
We have four missing soldiers, Captain, and no bodies. We need a supportable explanation.
Captain John Boyd is about to discover.
No one just ends up at Fort Spencer. We come for a reason.
Yours being?
Well,
something he never imagined.
We have a great sense of camaraderie here at Fort Spencer.
It's this Indian scout told me a curious story.
Wendigo.
It's an old Indian myth from the north.
Man eats the flesh of another. He absorbs the other man's strength.
Now, one man must choose.
We need others.
Between having dinner.
Not me.
And being dinner.
Good gracious.
That's so annoying.
Stu a la Major Knox.
Guy Pearce.
Ives! I'm gonna kill him.
Robert Carlyle.
He was tough, but then a good soldier ought to be.
Jeffrey Jones.
I bring you into the fold.
What's wrong?
David Arquette.
There's no guilt. I gotta eat. It's tough making friends.
Eat to live. Don't live to eat.
That was really sneaky.
He was licking me!
Ravenous.
Bon appetit.
The film opens begins in 1847 with Lieutenant Boyd being awarded a Medal of Bravery for his service in the Mexican-American War. But his superior officer knows the truth, that Boyd was able to cross enemy lines by playing dead. As punishment, Boyd is banished to a military outpost at Fort Spencer in the Sierra Nevada Range, along with some other military misfits led by Colonel Hart, an indigenous pair of scouts, George and Martha. Suddenly, a frostbitten man arrives at camp and recounts a terrible story of traveling with a group across the mountain range before a storm forced them into a cave for 3 months. The man, who calls himself Calhoun, claims that the American Colonel Ives was the first to resort to cannibalism in their group, and that he fled the cave, leaving Ives with a woman. Several members of the camp set off to rescue her, but not before their scout, George, describes the legendary Wendigo, an evil spirit who possesses men once they consume human flesh, causing great strength as well as an insatiable appetite. The group finds an extra skeleton in the cave, and it's revealed that Calhoun is in fact the murderous cannibal. He kills the rest of the group, but Boyd survives by eating some of a dead soldier's flesh and returns to the camp. When the camp receives their new commanding officer, Boyd is horrified to discover that it's Colonel Ives, aka Calhoun, and nobody believes his claim that Ives killed the rest of the group. When Colonel Hart miraculously makes it back to camp, Boyd discovers that he also survived Ives' attack through cannibalism and has agreed to join Ives in making cannibalism a lifestyle and feasting on the flesh of the Gold Rush, who will be passing through the area in the spring. So that's basically it. I mean, there is kind of a stinger ending.
But we will talk about that. And, you know, if you've heard of Ravenous, which I'm sure most of you have, you're probably familiar with it having a very troubled production history.
Very troubled.
Like, to the point where the fact that it just got made,
yeah,
whether you find it good or not, is a feat within itself.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, when it was in production and initially in development, they had another director on board, and the other director kind of went over budget and, you know, was having issues with the script and, you know, some very kind of, let's say, auteur problems.
Uh-huh.
And so he got fired. And then Fox brought in another director who at that point had only directed one film, which was Home Alone 3.
Very qualified.
Yep. The one that, I guess, doesn't have Donald Trump in it. And basically the whole cast revolted. This isn't the right guy. It's not, you know, the right person to take on this story. So everyone rejected this director, and then he got flown back to LA and directed Never Been Kissed. Then Robert Carlyle, who plays Calhoun / Ives, recommended a dear friend of his from back in the UK, a director by the name of Antonia Bird. And she has a really prolific career in British television, has worked on some really, really incredible shows as well as some films where she met Robert Carlyle. And, you know, they eventually formed a production company together, but he brought her on board. And he speaks very eloquently about this, how with a week to prep, she turned this production around and made this film her own and really created what you see on the screen. And it's, you know, very, very sad that just a few years ago she passed away.
Mm-hmm.
But she was a very exciting director. And in the interviews that I've seen with her, very articulate and thoughtful. And it's no surprise to me that she made this film that has so much brutality in it, but so much humor and thoughtfulness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the research I've done, like Carlyle, he didn't just recommend Antonia Bird. Mm-hmm. He didn't just suggest her and hope for the best. He, like, it was like a standoff. He was, mm-hmm, like, locked in his trailer. He was packing his bags. I am out of here unless it's her. And from what I have, she was considered for the role initially, but so she was a little bit prepared. Mm-hmm. But in the end, when she came aboard, she only had a week to prepare. And I also saw a couple of anecdotes from Carlyle about Antonia Bird showing up on set with this American crew. She's a British filmmaker. And just everybody needed to be spoon-fed,
yep,
for another... Mm-hmm. Culinary pun. Everyone needed to be micromanaged and told exactly what to do. And her and Robert were like looking at each other like, what the fuck, man? Nobody knows what they're doing. What a clusterfuck. So yes, indeed, I absolutely agree with you that it's a wonder this film was made at all. It's a wonder that it's great. I think it's great.
I think it's great, too.
We were talking about it a little before. I was saying how the first time I saw it, I remembered liking it. The second time I saw it, I kind of had it on in the background. It was on TV or something, and I wasn't fully paying attention, and I found it really strange. There was a lot of what the fuck moments. And then watching it again in preparation for this podcast, I was like, oh, that liking from the first watch and that what the fuck from the second watch were still there, but they came together and crystallized a lot better this last time around.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to talk a little bit about star power in this film. And this was something we talked about just recently in our Mother episode, and, you know, the way you can get a weird film made if you've got enough star power behind it. So keeping in mind the time that this film was made, so probably film 98, released 99, and you had, you know, its two leads who were indie actors, but the mid to late 90s were the time of, like, Hollywood indie. And so you had Guy Pearce, who's an Australian actor, and he made a splash in Hollywood as the lead or one of the leads, let's say, in L.A. Confidential. And Robert Carlyle had made kind of a splash in the mid-90s playing Begbie in Trainspotting. But then an even bigger splash, I would say, certainly in the mainstream, by playing the lead in The Full Monty. And so he had a lot of, like, cachet, particularly with Fox, which produced The Full Monty. So it was this tiny little film that blew up and became a sensation and did really, really well. And it's a very sweet film, but he could, you know, he had the power to say, I will lock myself in this trailer, I will pack my fucking bags, and a lot more Scottish swearing than I could ever do, I'm sure. And he can pull that card, and I think it's really cool that when someone can attain that level of, let's say, power or cachet in these situations, that, you know, they use it to benefit the project. To, you know, they could have all just laid down and say, yeah, I loved Home Alone 3, let's make this movie, I'll get my paycheck and go home. But it you know, they fought for, you know, this strange little story, and yeah, I just adore Robert Carlyle.
It's a strange little story, and not everybody could have pulled off a role like that the way Robert Carlyle did. He's such a wonderful example of not being traditionally beautiful and still being so fucking sexy.
He is, right?
Guy Pearce is super hot in this film as well. It's just like, damn, both of them. Geoffrey Jones as Colonel Hart, he's good, man.
He's good, but he's problematic.
I know, he's so problematic, but he is such a great actor, and he gives a wonderful interview in the special features of the Blu-ray of this film, a really articulate interview about what this film is saying, about Manifest Destiny, stuff like that that we're going to talk about. He also really went to bat for Antonia Bird. He was really fond of Carlyle and Pierce, and
I wish he wasn't a perv.
Yeah. I wish a lot of people weren't pervs.
So, you know, if you guys remember, and if you're a regular listener of the show, you may remember our horror comedy episode where I talked a little bit about the difference between a horror comedy and a comedy horror, essentially where, like, the foundation and the bones of the film lie, in which camp. You know, so I'd say Young Frankenstein and What We Do in the Shadows were both comedies that contained horror elements. For me, I would say Ravenous is a horror film that contains comedic elements.
I would agree with that.
And they occur in surprising moments, and they kind of, it hits you right off the bat, not necessarily with the quotes at the beginning, which are a little too tongue-in-cheek for me, but where you have Guy Pearce at the table, and he's been discharged, and he's getting this award, and he can't eat the steak in front of him, and he goes, and he throws up, and as the throw-up is coming out of his mouth, it's just, boom, ravenous.
Yeah.
And I just think that's brilliant. You didn't have to do that. No one had to do that. But it's such a poignant moment.
There's a playfulness and a silliness to this film that once you get it and you can get behind it, it doesn't at all water down the satire and the punch.
It
not to mention the horror
it.
Elements, you know. I can't name a whole lot of cannibalism movies, but the ones that I can name all kind of have a comedic slant. I don't know. I guess I'm thinking of Cannibal the Musical, which is more of a comedy than anything else. But cannibalism is one of those weird taboos in cinema where I feel like film is still kind of edgy on how they want to approach it. And comedy is a great way to get that medicine down.
And I think that time period which this film is set in cannot be ignored. The 1840s, it was a really pivotal time for America, and a really complicated and, frankly, a pretty gross time for America. And
not your proudest moment.
No. I'd like to say you've done better, America, but
You still can.
You brought us Mark Ruffalo.
Thank you.
But when, a term that gets mentioned, it's almost a little throwaway in the film, but it's so deeply entrenched in the sauce of this film. And that's the term manifest destiny.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not quite sure what that is, you may have heard of it in passing or maybe back in school. And this was a term that was coined in 1845. And it's an ideology of territorial expansion by European immigrants in the United States of America. And the idea is that this expansion, this territorial take-up, was divined by God. God was willing these white American immigrants to take over this country
mm-hmm.
and make it their own at the cost of seemingly anything. And the kind of, you know, high-minded ideals of it were to expand democracy and capitalism across mm-hmm. this land. Basically, you know, you probably know if it's European settlers, they were coming over the Atlantic. So they were landing on the East Coast. That's where you get the kind of notion of New England and things like that. But at the beginning of the 19th century, in the early 1800s, there was a significant amount of overcrowding. The birth rate, it just exploded. And there were two economic depressions in 1819 and 1839. And this led these immigrant settlers to look west.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't a place where they had necessarily been before. They kind of had their like little enclaves on the east and they were urbanizing them and it was all very up and coming, but it was the notion that you could look west and find your fortune. Now, in 1803, there was the Louisiana Purchase, and that nearly doubled the U.S.'s size at the time. And President Jefferson, who was president at that point, supported the expedition of Lewis and Clark. So there was a sense of nobleness to looking west, to
morality,
to explore, to kind of to like literally spreading this, you know, Christian Protestant gospel.
Mm-hmm.
So by 1845, the notion of expanding all the way to the Pacific had taken hold in the minds and hearts of these new Americans. And so you have something like the Mexican-American War. That was a war of expansion and a war of manifest destiny. They mm-hmm. saw it as their place to displace people who lived there. They were displacing and brutalizing indigenous culture throughout what we now know as America or the United States. And so the Mexican-American War actually ended in 1848 with the U.S. receiving 525,000 square miles, including what is now known as California, Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming.
Okay.
So you know, they're on the up and up, let's say. And again, we're talking about brutal, horrifying treatment of the indigenous population and as well as the Hispanic population of Mexico. And this expansion raised a lot more questions in America about slavery. So a lot of people point to it as the beginnings of the Civil War. Now, what's kind of strange about when you look back at this time is it has been so idealized
mm-hmm.
in the minds of so many of this, you know, purposeful thing that people did and they were just seeking their fortune and good for them. But the displacement, the hardship, the trauma that occurred because of it can't be overstated. And I don't often see that depicted in film, television, in any media really at all,
mm-hmm.
Unless it's coming from an indigenous population. So I think that's why Ravenous is kind of a special film, because it not only shows the hardships of that time, it depicts the seemingly necessary brutality that these people had to inflict in order to manifest their destiny.
Yeah, exactly. Or entitlement, if you want to call it. And that rhetoric is not, it's not in the past, guys.
Mm-mm.
There's talk of a wall, and that's not a far cry. And the film doesn't just imply these things. Like, it's really front and center.
Mm-hmm.
I liked how it was presented almost immediately in that flag.
Mm-hmm.
That flag with that particular configuration of the stars and stripes, it sets the stage right away. And then Boyd's quote-unquote cowardice, which we're going to talk a little bit more about later, is just presenting the fact that, man, some people on the front lines weren't even okay with what they were doing. Some people on the front lines might have been branded a coward when actually their moral compass was pointing more toward a heroic direction.
Well, yes, and we can talk about that later.
I hope we do.
So this kind of ideology led to something that is commonly known as the frontier myth or the myth of the West. And that has, you know, gone from the 19th century when this film is set into what I would consider in the 20th century being labeled the American dream. Mm-hmm. You know, that if you work hard, if you play hard, if you have the wherewithal to try, you will receive something out of it. You will have a really good life.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Fuck me. So there's actually a quote that I really like from this scholar by the name of Richard Slotkin, and it's that the American myth of the West is an America as a wide open land of unlimited opportunity for the strong, ambitious, self-reliant individual who thrusts his way to the top. Mm-hmm. So I think it's interesting the way this film treats individualism. Mm-hmm. Guy Pearce or Boyd is functioning as, you know, a lone agent in his cowardice. He is scared. He doesn't want to be part of it, or he panics. And whatever reptile part of your brain takes over and you decide to do not the thing you're told to do. Whereas Ives's thing is he needs to create a community of cannibals.
Yep. And spread it and spread it and spread it. And I'm not super well versed in the Western film genre. Mm-hmm. What couple I have seen is it just seems really macho, really steeped in this masculine anti-hero, dirty, hairy type thing. And I'm just not into it.
Yeah. I mean, the Western was hugely popular, through the I'd say mainly through the kind of, 40s and 50s. Like, we're really thinking like John Wayne, just kind of sidling up into a town and righting the wrongs and, let's maybe include some problematic depictions of indigenous culture and, all of that. And it's gone through semi-resurgences. I'm thinking of, some of Clint Eastwood's films and stuff like that. So you had the spaghetti westerns in the 70s. And then in the 90s, you had the other Eastwood film, Unforgiven, which is a really good film, but it's hearkening back to this kind of man as defender. Mm-hmm. And then, I'd say even more in more recent years, in fact, very recently, we've had films like Bone Tomahawk, Westworld, and even the new Coen Brothers film, which is on Netflix, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. Mm-hmm. It's an anthology film about frontier and Western and stuff like that. And it also includes some problematic depictions as well as some very interesting depictions and some interesting ideas. So it's a complicated genre. It's going from, taking something that is a problematic, dark, gross period of history and making it heroic, at least in its initial place. And, then it goes on and, and you see in things like Westworld or things like that where it kind of is, trying to wrestle with some of the ideals of it a bit more. But for me, I just think I was so impressed by the way Ravenous just made all of this shit problematic, deeply problematic.
That's
that
right.
I think even if you didn't have all this context, you could still go, wait, that whole situation was fucked up. And
right.
It's not in this like hot California sun and this desert. It's in fucking snowy California.
Yeah, which I didn't even know was a thing. I'm not going to lie. My geography of the U.S. is crap. And this wasn't filmed in the U.S. either.
No, it wasn't.
I just add.
Yeah.
So I'm so glad you mentioned the frontier as something that's part of American history and part of America's, preoccupation with the Western expansion and so on and so forth. When I wrote a chapter for that Canadian horror book, I was looking at Margaret Atwood. And Margaret Atwood, as you probably know, is a Canadian writer, but she's also a Canadian literary critic. And she wrote on Canadian literature. And one of her contributions to Canadian literature criticism was drawing from Northrop Frye's idea of the garrison mentality, which is to say that Canadian literature appeared to have a preoccupation with the wilderness. It appeared to have a very outward-looking, wall-building preoccupation, which I realize is a little bit ironic after the reference I made to the wall a little bit earlier. But what Atwood did is she kind of expanded that Garrison mentality to distill it into a single term, such that if American literature was preoccupied with the frontier, Canadian literature was preoccupied with survival, as opposed to the island in British literature and the frontier in the U.S. And that was kind of a presumption that the Canadian wilderness landscape was so hostile. It wasn't – you didn't look at these vast swaths of land as something to be conquered. You looked at it as something to be survived, something that was very hostile and then that could indeed kill you and that you had to garrison up against it, for lack of a better term. Another reason why I bring up Atwood is she wrote a Wendigo story, and it was called Oryx and Crake, wherein she uses the term Wendigo as a verb, which I thought was so interesting. Like, one might go Wendigo, or one might become Wendigo. It was kind of understood as a weakened or corrupted state of mind, which I think is something that's interesting when applied to this film. And Atwood would go on to say that while the white man fears the wilderness for its emptiness, the indigenous consider the wilderness to be full and full of not only resources, but monsters and danger and effects on human beings that could be feared, including the symbolic and many-faceted Wendigo. Did you do a lot of research on the Wendigo?
I did a bit.
Because it's everywhere. It's a really – it's kind of an amorphous concept.
Yeah, and that's – something that comes up in this film. It comes up in folklore across a lot of North American literature, including, you know, Stephen King's Pet Sematary.
Yes.
Which looks like they're going to tackle in the new film. So let's see what that looks like.
But you haven't seen the trailer.
It autoplayed, Andrea.
Oh,
it
I'm so sorry.
As the Wendigo can take many forms and can have many narrative uses, let's say, in this film, they give it a really specific use. Mm-hmm. That it's seemingly this kind of possession-like thing where it touches you or it takes you, and as soon as you start consuming flesh, you absorb power, energy, strength of the person who you eat. Mm-hmm. So it helps you heal, it helps you get stronger, it, you know, cures your mental health issues.
Oh.
Well, remember when Ives is talking about he had depression and things like that, along with tuberculosis, and now he's great. And so some of the stuff that I found was that for many indigenous tribes, the Wendigo was could have been once human, and it was humans who resorted to cannibalism, and then they began to shift, and they began to alter, and they began to turn into something monstrous.
Now, cannibalism, I mentioned before, is such an interesting thing. It's such an interesting taboo because there's a lot of contradictions within that taboo. And it's something that I looked at in my thesis because one of the things I was arguing, if you remember our George Romero episode when we looked at his big trilogy, I guess, is I talked about how cannibalism is a trait that was attributed to zombies in the Americanized context. The original Haitian voodoo zombies were not cannibals. They were not interested in eating people at all. That was completely novel, something that George Romero imbued on his zombies. And I read that as very culturally significant because cannibalism has its roots in racism. Cannibalism was an indictment that the white man applied to indigenous populations to justify subjugating them. They're savages, they're cannibals, like they clearly have no respect for human life because they're eating other people. Is anything more monstrous? And post-colonial scholars have largely debunked that, saying that these accounts were either exaggerated or completely fabricated out of nowhere. Now, cannibalism is, again, a really amorphous term. It can be applied to pretty much any system of domination. It can be applied to capitalism, it can be applied to sexism, anything involving domination of one group over another. Karl Marx actually used like vampirism as the metaphor, but reduced to commodities, human beings become little more than fuel or food, and that's what he was getting at. And on a wider scale, the West can be understood as cannibalizing the rest of the world, even today. Cannibalism is never beneficial to both parties. It's one or the other, and it's a dog-eat-dog kind of thing. But what's interesting about cannibalism is it has this duality. Like, there's something of a contradiction in this cultural taboo, in that civilized people are understood not to eat human flesh because it's repugnant. It repulses us on a very deep, innate level, that it's unnatural, it's animalistic. But in the case of utter and total desperation, it's survival. It's inevitable. It's natural. So how can something be natural and unnatural at the same time? And I feel like the answer to this really boils down to where you stand with regard to humanity and what humanity is and the line between human beings and animals. And you hear so many competing philosophies about whether human beings should be eating meat at all, whether or not we have a biological imperative to consume animals, whether or not we're part of the food chain, or whether our increased intellect presents us with a moral obligation to come up with an alternative sustenance. And as an aside, Antonia Bird is a vegetarian.
Ah, and so is Guy Pearce, right?
Is that right?
Yeah. Apparently he used to, like, throw up when he had to do the soup scene.
It's too big a question for us to answer here, but I really feel like that's at the heart of Ravenous. Like, we see Boyd consuming flesh to stay alive, at first by accident, but later as a direct effort to stay alive long enough to stop the cannibals. Colonel Hart, we get the sense that he's an educated man. He's interested in philosophy and morality. And insofar as he's temporarily swayed by Ives, he invites his own murder in order to stop this cycle of cannibalism. And as for Ives, he's too far gone, and he feels no guilt for his actions. And indeed, he's the one who makes the direct link between his power-hungry cannibalism and the military quest for dominance over the land and its occupants.
Well, and let's, you know, so you mentioned it a couple times, and it was actually quite illuminating for me to just go back and look at what the definition of colonialism is. Ooh. Because, you know, I know what it is. Kind of, we talk a lot about it. We should be. Anyway, the way, you know, England in particular and other kind of Western European nations have colonized a lot of places. Mm-hmm. So, the kind of general definition of colonialism that I found is the policy or practice of acquiring full or partial control over another country, occupying it with settlers and exploiting it economically. So that's a use of natural resources that are being corrupted for another people's use. And I think that to me really spoke to the unnaturalness of Ives and what he does. Mm-hmm. You get the sense that Boyd, you know, he survived and it was accidental. He's, you know, he's at the bottom of all these bodies and the blood is leaking into his mouth. And then he's a coward and he thinks it's all over. And then he finds the strength to kind of overtake this Mexican armament during the war. And that's kind of the shifty, shady thing that he does where the army's like, okay, you get this award, but please go the fuck away. Mm-hmm. And then with Ives, it's like he didn't just do it to survival. He did it for pleasure. He did it to become stronger. He did it to become the best. And the exploitative nature, which, you know, all across Europe, especially if you look, you know, towards Russia, has done, and, you know, then America really did in the 20th century, of the subjugation of, you know, many different countries and the continued subjugation of many European countries, you know, had in other poorer countries during the 20th century. It wasn't for the good of the people in another country. It was to benefit them. It was to get cheap trade. It was to get labor. It was to do things more horrifying than a horror film could ever tackle.
To exploit them, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that really mirrors, it also mirrors their participation in the military, where, you know, they signed up because you really have no choice if you're an American at the time. But there's a difference between somebody who's morally conflicted and you know, might be branded a coward, and somebody like Ives, who just leans into the carnage and drinks up all that imperialism Kool-Aid.
So this notion of cannibalism within the film, it's not only horrific, it's not only filmic, it's because it's such a visceral thing to experience when you watch it. You know, watching, you know, blood drip down someone's mouth and, you know, they're eating another person. It's a really beautiful, tactile thing to portray on screen. So I think this was a really smart metaphor to use for Western expansion, for colonialism, for capitalism. Mm-hmm. You know, and you talked a lot about this in your book. We talked about it in our George Romero episode, about the notion of the need to consume and the need to kind of take all these things on. And what's great about Ravenous is that it's not that far from any truth or any folklore that already exists in America. Now, I'm sure a lot of you out there have heard of something called the Donner Party. And this is something I've always been kind of interested in, and I've always wanted to research a bit more, like actually go out and buy some books on it and read it.
I know it from The Shining.
Yeah, The Shining. It kind of, like, in a lot of horror films, it gets mentioned. It's like this little callback thing. So I knew it was a bunch of settlers who were going westward and they kind of ate each other. But I went a little bit more in depth, not as in depth as I would one day like to go.
Okay.
But, you know, to really break it down in terms of how it can relate to Ravenous and in our discussion today, it was this, you know, party of people. Mm-hmm. They were set out for California from Missouri via a wagon train in May 1846. And the journey should have taken them 4 to 6 months, but they decided to go a brand new route. Mm-hmm. And then they got snowed in.
Oh, no.
And they got snowed in the kind of Sierra Nevada area. And this is kind of close to where Ravenous takes place. Mm-hmm. And you know, there was an early snowstorm in 1846. So not only were they taking longer because they'd taken a different route, but then they got waylaid by the snowstorm. They were trapped. And by mid-December, they kind of hunkered down and tried to ride out this snow. But by mid-December, their food supplies were diminished. And a number of the group, just over 80 when they set out, so the kind of most able-bodied ones had left to go travel ahead to California, see if they could get help for the rest of the group. Mm-hmm. And by the time this, you know, rescue crew showed up in February 1847, there were only 48 of the original 87 people left.
Wow.
And the members of the party have varying stories, the ones that survived. And the 48 people went on and, you know, lived out their lives in California. Some of them wrote books. Some of them have very conflicting stories. But the most commonly held one seems to be that, you know, very sadly, some people died. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, a crazy time, so they just decided to eat those people.
What?
And then there is, you know, there's a lot of conjecture because there was no CCTV back in the day. There was no CCTV Donner Party. Though, you know, if Dimension Extreme is still functioning, I'm sure they're stealing that idea right now.
I hope so. How is there not a Donner Party movie?
There, I think there is.
Really?
I feel like there's a really cheapy one out there. But I don't know. Basically, you have these conflicting reports, but no one will, other than those 48 people who are dead, mm-hmm. I hope now, no one will ever kind of know the truth. So you kind of go from people either being on one end of the spectrum, which is, you know what, nothing really that strange happened and we just survived and everything's okay and we got through it, mm-hmm. to they were fucking killing people and eating them and, mm-hmm. you know, dancing around naked around their bones. I don't know. There's a lot of that recounted when you hear Calhoun's story, mm-hmm. at the beginning of the film. And then there's another character from America Past. And I really love this.
Tell me.
So this is how this guy is referred to. Alfred Packer, Cannibal Prospector.
Alfred Packer is the subject of Cannibal the Musical that I mentioned before. Yes. And that's so funny because I've seen Cannibal the Musical. It's a movie by Trey Parker and Matt Stone, mm-hmm. of South Park. It's very silly. But there's this gag where they go to a store and one of them picks up some fudge. And then later when they're starving, somebody just quips, "Fudge Packer?" And I honestly thought the character was named Packer just for that quip, because I would not put that past Trey Parker and Matt Stone to do.
But no, he was a real person.
All right.
I truly need to change my LinkedIn profile to Cannibal Prospector. No, but he was someone who, you know, lived in, you know, the mid-19th century, was a prospector in the West and, you know, had a terrible time of it and then just lured men up until this, like, remote mountain area, mm-hmm. and ate them, mm. and did it for about 2 months. And he was put on trial, this very strange kind of life where he went from like an honest man trying to make his work life happen, mm-hmm. to a cannibal, to evil, to kind of a folklore hero.
Right.
And there's a lot of literature about him. But through my research about him, I did discover something very interesting, which is that cannibalism is not illegal in the states anywhere except Idaho.
Oh,
which actually means you cannot be tried for cannibalism. You can be tried for, like, fucking up a corpse, like desecration, but not for cannibalism.
Hey.
I know. The more you know. Unless you're in Idaho, then don't do it.
It's one of those weird, like, loophole things where it's not actually illegal to do drugs, but it's illegal to have them, you know?
Yeah, one of the authors I was reading today who's kind of put a lot of work into the cannibal prospector has said, you know, had he had a good lawyer, there was clearly enough reasonable doubt for him to get off.
Well, yeah, I was going to say Cannibal the Musical, obviously it's a very ridiculous slapstick comedy, but it positioned him as innocent, that like everybody was cannibals except him, but he's the one who went down for it. You know, there's, if you bite your nails.
Which I do.
You know, when my eldest sister gave birth, when she had her first child, it was kind of the first grandchild for my parents. It was the first kind of next generation. I wanted to eat her placenta. I heard that it was really, really good for you. I heard that you could fry it up like liver. And, you know, I get why that's not illegal. She wouldn't let me, but it's not a crime.
Unless you're in Idaho.
You would not consume human flesh if given the opportunity?
No, I probably would.
Of course you would. I'm told it tastes like pork.
Does it really?
Yeah, I'm told that it's like a white meat like that. I'm told. I'm told by the internet. I'm told by my deepest, darkest Googlings.
I mean, you know, we could probably just wait for Dustin until he comes home.
Dustin would be delicious.
This whole film kind of reminded me of one of the few very, very vivid memories I have as a child. Mm. And that's, I must have been maybe 5 or 6. It's definitely going into like grade one. And you know, my mom and I, you know, I was born and raised in Toronto. And then when I was about 5 or 6, we moved to Montreal. So that was the very early 90s. And I think it was in 1989. There's a really horrifying shooting in Montreal at L'École Polytechnique, which is a man walked into a technical school, college, and asked for all the women to be rounded up and shot women.
It was a hate crime.
It was a hate crime. Yeah, and it's still something that Canada is dealing with, and it was fucking horrific. But my mom, being my lovely protective mother at the time, knew we were obviously moving to Montreal and I was going into grade one. And I remember her telling me, because I was starting this new school and it was all French immersion and I didn't speak French and I didn't really, like, it was hard for me to make friends. And it was just all like, it was a lot of anxiety I had about it. And then I remember her saying to me, honey, if a shooter comes into your school, I want you to play dead. And if you feel the need to, like, put some of the blood from someone else on you so you look like you're dead.
Shit. She told you to do that?
Yeah. I remember it, too.
It's not bad advice, but holy fuck.
No, and it's interesting to me as I was, you know, watching this film again, that's clearly what Boyd kind of does.
100%.
He just kind of, like, he doesn't get hit or anything. Yeah. He doesn't, like, react. He just kind of, like, slowly lies down and then just lies there.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, God, you listen to Diana West.
You know, I'm already eating my words about what I said earlier about horror not really tackling cannibalism, because it just occurred to me that there is a really fucked up movie based on a true account. I think it was in Germany. Mm. I'm going to pull a My Favorite Murder right here and just talk completely unresearched about this. But somebody put an ad in newspaper, like a classified ad, being like, I would like to eat you. And if you're into that, let me know. And this guy actually got a bite. And in the movie, this movie that I saw, I believe it's just called Cannibal. And forgive me, I will put more information in the course notes because I will dig it up, because I found this film. It's a foreign language film. I can't remember if it was German or French. It might have been a bit of both.
Like a fucking German movie.
But it was really surprisingly tragic. It was very graphic and violent and vile and disgusting. But basically, according to the movie, these two men had a love affair.
Mm.
They had a romantic thing. And watching the movie, I was like, is he going to eat him? But he's in love with him. But then one of them was like, no, you agreed to eat me. And it turned into this whole, oh, man, it's such a fucked up movie. I just really wanted to bring it up.
Oh, no, I'm glad you did.
Okay.
I think what's interesting for me is the notion of Boyd's cowardice. It's mentioned a couple times in the film, but it feels like it's such a central thematic point, because I think this is something that our Western culture grapples with a lot. we are expected to take care of ourselves. Mm-hmm. We are expected to, you know, if we want to go seek fortune, you have to go seek fortune, you know, in the time of this film, it was by heading west.
Yes.
By doing this or joining the army or doing your bit. And it will take care of you because God wills it. And then we're also left so very much on our own. Mm. So very much on our own. And it's, you know, we I think kind of play between the struggle of joining an ideology and doing what's best for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And whether that ideology is, you know, a bigger movement, a political movement, social movement, or something like that, even like a cultural movement.
Yeah.
And then when you stand in opposition to that, it leaves you in a very lonely place. And I think there's something that is so tangible about it, but it's hard to articulate.
Well, it's still the context that we're living in a way where it's kill or be killed. Mm-hmm. It's a dog eat dog world. You know, like these are terms that we just throw around, but if you're not happy with capitalism, if you're not happy with the way the United States or Canada is being run and you're a resident of those countries, like, good luck. You have to play the game. You have to get a job. Mm-hmm. You have to work. You have to do things that you don't want to do. You have to participate in this cultural cannibalism to a certain extent just to survive. But you don't have to like it. And you can be a coward within it, you know, the way I kind of am.
You know, look at, you know, you go from something extreme like the opportunities or lack of opportunities Boyd is presented within this film and the way you feel like, you know, I'm 33, and now I'm kind of starting to feel like, oh, I don't think culture is still quite aimed at me. Mm-mm. And, oh, that's a little bit isolating. And the other thing I think about a lot when I think about this kind of North American, almost zero-sum game, is what I learned about when I was in high school and have kind of returned to is the notion of how the Russians helped win World War II. Mm. No one was allowed to turn back. Like, they had the people behind them with guns pointed at their back, so unless they marched forward, they were going to die.
Terrifying.
And there were so many, like, they just died. Like, there were just bodies everywhere. And I think this is also a really interesting film for a portrayal of PTSD in a man.
Mm-mm.
And I think whether, you know, you look at it now as PTSD or whether you maybe didn't know it at the time, you know, when it came out in 1999, I don't think there was nearly as much talk about PTSD as there is now.
Absolutely not.
But the fact that this film kind of portrays that something traumatic happened to Boyd,
mm-hmm.
and he will be grappling with it forever. And even, you know, Calhoun/Ives calls out depression.
Yeah.
And it was like, wow, this is a film that is dealing with these seemingly things that are really hard to talk about for men in their most kind of masculine element. They are the frontier. They're
in the military.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you brought that up because, as is typical with Faculty of Horror, you know, I watch the film maybe a week or two in advance. I take a couple of notes. I think that I'm going to think about it. I think that I'm going to think about it in the shower when in the shower I'm actually thinking about my next tattoo or whatever the fuck. But I always find something really interesting like a half hour before we record, and that was absolutely the case this time. I came across this article on a website called bitchflix.com, but it's like there's no I in bitch. It's like
cool millennial version of
there's no vowels. It's bitchflix.com.
I have an article on there.
Do you really?
Yeah, but I think it was about Basic Instinct.
Okay. Well, wicked. Let's link that, too, just for the fuck of it.
They're a really good site.
But I will link to this, and this is an article that was written in 2017. It's not super new, but it introduced a term that I'd never heard before that so excited me. Basically, this writer talks about how Antonia Bird's gaze avoids something that they refer to as man pain, quote-unquote man pain.
And is it like man cold?
Kind of. Okay. Actually, kind of. Man pain is where something terrible happens to the male protagonist's girlfriend or wife, and the focus is on the protagonist's reaction to the situation rather than the victim's pain. Mm-hmm. So do you remember we were talking between us about Brawl and Cell Block?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
It's exactly like that, where the wife is doing things, but it's not about her.
She was just trying to chop a pepper.
She was just inciting a reaction. She only existed to incite a reaction out of him. And so applied to this film, what the writer goes on to say is that, you know, particularly in Calhoun's recounting of his ordeal. The camera focuses on him instead of Boyd. When he's talking about what happened, it's all about Calhoun, which really subverts this trope, and it does so without making him out to be weak or effeminate. And admittedly, Calhoun isn't a lady, so maybe it doesn't correspond exactly, but men aren't typically permitted to show pain or fear ever in film, in military, ever. And they are throughout this film. As for Boyd, you know, he represses his emotions as much as possible. I agree. I absolutely agree that he has PTSD. Mm-hmm. I think that's exactly what made him shut down. And I think the film depicted that very sympathetically. And it shows the problematic nature of military machismo, toxic masculinity, whatever. He's not the conventional hero, even though his final act is quite sacrificial and heroic. But he came to this heroism through his personal beliefs and not out of any gendered role-playing or military expectation or notions of duty or American or anything like that. And what that triggered in me was the idea that I mentioned before that this film is always trotted out as one horror film that's been directed by women, but she didn't write it. Nope. And indeed, she wasn't involved in the initial stages of pre-production. So she wouldn't have been involved in, let's say, the, what do you call it when they make the comic book?
Oh, storyboards?
Yeah. You know, shit like that. So it makes
casting.
Me. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, casting is crucial to this film. She wasn't involved, and yet I would call this film feminist by virtue of the way it problematizes traditional masculinity, and it affords these male figures some emotion and some pathos that aren't drenched in traditional masculinity. So if you're asking yourself, can a male-directed film be feminist? Is a lady-directed film necessarily feminist? It reminds me of when I had a YouTube channel, I made a video about Session 9.
Yes. Yeah.
And I called it a feminist film. Mm. All male cast, directed by a male, I maintain that it's a feminist film because it has these feminist tenets. And I think that's true of Ravenous, even though Antonia Bird only came on board 2 weeks into shooting.
Yeah. I mean, for as problematic as I think Never Been Kissed is, I think Ravenous is bringing a lot of things to the forefront and normalizing them. Boyd is the hero.
Yeah.
He, you know, has this kind of label as a coward.
But I don't consider him a coward.
Because when it counts, he sacrifices himself, not only because he knows he kind of needs to at this point, but because he knows if he plays this right, he can take down Ives as well.
Well, there's that. And his motivation for his heroism is deep down. He's like, this is wrong. I will lay my life on the line for this, but to lay my life on the line for American expansion?
Yeah.
Fuck off.
Well, and I think, you know, the notion of militarized heroism, you know, and that's not to say people who work in the military aren't brave and heroic.
Absolutely.
And go to work every day not knowing what will happen next. That's not to say that at all. The issue I have is when a spoiled fucking little rich boy who inherited all his money from his father is sitting at the commander-in-chief's chair of the United States of America and is making calls that affect people who are putting themselves willingly in the line of fire. That pisses me off.
Oh, yeah. That turns my stomach worse than any cannibalism story I've ever heard.
And that's where I think this kind of dichotomy of Ravenous plays out is you will always have people at a seat of power who have most likely never been through what the people on the ground are going to go through. Mm-hmm. You know, I think John McCain, no matter what you believed or didn't believe or agreed with or didn't agree with his politics, he was a prisoner of war during the Vietnam War. And that was, you know,
no fucking joke.
That's no fucking joke. And the way he talked about it and the way in his political career that he handled military policy was, you know, it was conservative, but it was someone who'd been through it.
It was human.
Yeah. And I actually think that's a really interesting point you brought up, Andrea, about a kind of feminism as portrayed through male characters. And I think that's something that we often kind of lob at when we talk about the gender of a director, you know, that certain things are feminist and certain things aren't feminist. And, you know, I think that's tricky. I think that kind of narrows our own audience gaze. a little bit too much.
I agree. If it challenges patriarchal concepts, I consider that a feminist thing. And this podcast is predicated on, you know, like a deeper analysis of a lot of films made by men. And a lot of them do that. And we can celebrate the feminist elements in them.
Yeah. And I think it's really interesting that by no means all or even the majority, but a lot of female directors who I kind of think about, well, you know, when we talked earlier in the episode about, you know, there's those like five films that always get trotted out for women.
Pet Cemetery, American Psycho,
Near Dark. Mm-hmm. They're very much driven by male narratives, but the sensitivity shown through a female gaze are in some ways very subtle, in some ways very overt. And I think when we talk about Ravenous as a feminist film, that's something that a female director, in my opinion, can bring to a table. Mm-hmm. And it's not to say a male director can't do that, because, you know, there's many films directed by men that I considered feminist. And if I didn't have that connection to male directors, and if there weren't male directors who are out there who are sensitive and intelligent people, I would not have fallen in love with film.
No.
Because they're the majority, the vast majority.
Completely excluded from the medium, exactly.
Yeah. But all that to say, I think this is a really special film for the way it is directed, for the decisions that Antonia Bird made when she was brought on board. One of the things I really love about this film is the score.
Yes, let's talk about the score.
It's a fun score.
It is the most conspicuous score I can name in recent memory, where it's like, what is going on with the music?
And part of that for me is I am a massive fan of Damon Albarn, and he did the score with Michael Nyman, who's a more traditional, like, composer, let's say.
That's right. And what I'm reading about the film is that they did the soundtrack to the film together, but also largely independently. They each contributed their own thing, and I think that's part of why the score seems uneven, inconsistent even.
And for anyone who doesn't know, Damon Albarn, he was the lead singer of Blur, one of the creative forces behind Gorillaz. He's done a ton of other stuff, and I think he's just a very interesting, talented individual, and someone who, whenever I see his name attached to something, I get kind of excited because I love his tongue-in-cheekness. And the main kind of theme, the musical theme of Ravenous, it has a very Blur-like element to it. And, you know, as soon as it was playing, I kind of started bobbing my head to it. And I was like, I like this. I love the scene when they kind of first realize that Calhoun is not what he appears to be.
And it's this jaunty, upbeat, silly, crazy thing that is so contrary to the dread of the realization.
And for me, and I think, again, it's one of those moments, and I think you have to watch for these moments in film where they call attention to themselves. Elements like editing, score, a lot of the technical things, cinematography, other things like that, they're supposed to be, and I've heard this, you know, referred to it as invisible. Okay. They are supposed to exist and inform, but on a really subtle level. So it's not usually until you go back to like maybe a second, third, fourth watch that you really start kind of piecing out, whoa, what was that editing like? What was that score like? How did that inform it?
That's right. Like traditionally, if you notice it, it's done something wrong.
Exactly. And so I think in this film, and what Ravenous does is it calls attention to its genres, plural, and to the intentions of the characters. So you have this kind of masculinized, you know, there's a bad guy. We've identified the bad guy. We're going to go chase him down and go get him. And it's got this boom, 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 kind of, you know, score to it. So it's calling attention to this kind of silly nature of it.
Well, he gets really impish and silly when he's stalking them down. He's like, hee hee.
Again, I think that's just another layer to this film that makes it distinct. And I'm not sure if another director would have made those choices, but I'm glad they exist, because this film and this narrative and the story that it's telling is essentially really simple. It's a man grappling with morality, you know, the sense of self versus the larger self. How do you define the larger self or community? What does that mean? And Boyd's ultimate sacrifice is for humanity, whereas Ives or Calhoun is kind of running around going like, I'm creating a community, but it's a community to support me.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that very interesting. And another thing I want to mention as we kind of wrap up is something that I saw mentioned quite a bit when I was reading about the film, which is the homoeroticism of the film,
mm-hmm.
Particularly between Boyd and Ives. And, you know, some people really see this film as an allegory for homosexuality, that Ives is kind of foisting a sexuality upon Boyd, things like that. And I don't think I'll ever truly reject someone's interpretation of a film.
No.
Like, if you see it and you can substantiate it and make an argument for it, cool. It doesn't mean that everyone's going to agree with it. I think the thing is because Ives is such a dark entity in this film and such a corrupted entity in this
mm-hmm.
film, if you equate that with homosexuality, I don't like what it has to say about homosexuality.
Oh.
Because it implies that it's something that can be foisted upon other people, that is something that is potentially unnatural, maybe. I think it's a complicated reading. And again, I'm saying this as a straight woman, so I'm not the expert, but it's something that it speaks to the kind of problematic history of America in a really interesting way. And it kind of problematizes it in a really interesting way. But I think to kind of equate it with the sexuality that so many people have been prosecuted for is a little problematic for me. I think there is a kind of chemistry and a tension between Guy Pearce and Robert Carlyle. And I think if you're going to have a kind of demonic figure, no matter what the gender and no matter what the gender of the quote unquote good person, you want to have a bit of flirtation, a bit of, you know, something going on. So I don't dislike that kind of energy that exists within the film, but I think to equate it as homosexual might be not right. But again, I could be totally wrong about that.
To that end, I'll say this, and this is something that I encountered when I was talking about cannibalism with regard to George Romero's films and how it shares a lot of the same pedigree as vampirism in that there's this parasitic thing, there's me feeding off you, there's me living necessarily by you dying. And yet when it comes to vampires and when it comes to blood, there's an eroticism to it. However, cannibals and certainly zombies are not at all depicted as sexual beings. However, toward the end of Ravenous, when we see Ives and, you know, he's got his military uniform that has a higher collar, his hair is kind of slicked back. When he puts that cross of blood on his head, it has a very Dracula vampiric seduction to it.
Yeah.
And there's definitely an element of him trying to kind of seduce Boyd onto his side, trying to romanticize. We can do this together. Like, join us. Be one of us. Be part of us. So that's maybe as far as I would take that line of reasoning.
Yeah, and I think as, you know, whenever you've got kind of two objectives at odds with each other, someone's always going to use the tactic of coercion. And you're going to coerce in different ways. You're going to coerce through logic. You're going to coerce through compliments. You're going to do a whole number of things to get someone on your side. So I think the flirtation or any kind of just general energy between those two, it exists and it's not something to be angry about. But I'm not sure that I see it as a full-on thematic metaphor for homosexuality.
I could maybe see a parallel in that we're busting taboos here.
Yeah.
We're busting taboos in that the military man has to be this macho, total sacrificial lamb. And, you know, if we're going to be cannibals, if we're going to break the rules, let's fucking break the rules.
And I mean, again, just to, you know, sing Robert Carlyle's praises once more, you know, again, as I mentioned in Trainspotting, he was like the kind of bully, toxic masculinity.
Totally, yeah.
Terrible figure in that film, but amazing in it. In Full Monty, he was this like kind, deeply empathetic guy who just wanted to do right by his kid and told toxic masculinity to fuck off, and he was going to have fun and do the best thing he could for his family. And in this one, he's just like, I'm a sexy man. I was dirty when I came in, and now I'm a fucking hottie. And so I like the dichotomy that he can play with and that he uses as an actor. So I'm not angry that it's in the film. I'm just not sure that it is my main takeaway from it. But I did want to mention it is something that is written about a lot for the film. And maybe you, listener, have an opinion about it. And please, if I'm wrong about that, you know, send me a note.
Yeah, have at her.
Yeah. So I also had a couple thoughts around the way gender is talked about in this film. And as I was mentioning, it's a very masculine film.
Well, there's not a lot of ladies.
There's not a lot of ladies. You've got Martha, who's the indigenous woman who is basically like, fuck you guys, bye. Mm-hmm. She very, very clearly knows something is up from very early on.
These white men are going to tear each other apart and I'm out.
Yeah. And I love her. but there is another woman in the film. She doesn't appear on screen, but she is mentioned. And that is the woman who Calhoun/Ives travels with. Mm-hmm. And he uses her as the kind of linchpin to get this group of masculine army men.
The rescue motivation.
To go rescue this woman. It's not to see if, you know, there's this guy and he might have gone a little crazy, but we should probably go rescue him. It's like, no, there was a woman left there and I was
a
coward
woman?
And I left.
Call the cavalry.
And they all fucking suit up and they go. And again, it's a kind of play into the fallacy of the Western myth. It's going to save the woman tied to the train tracks. Mm. It's going to be the knights in shining armor. I think, was it Colonel Hart even says at one point, well, this is what we do. We just go and we do it. And he can be referring to a rescue mission or just going to save the damsel in distress. Mm-hmm. But I think when you get to a few scenes later and you realize that this is really a trap, how ingenious that trap is, because it plays on our expectations of masculinity. It plays on our expectations as an audience. And it's a subtle thing, but I thought it's, again, another way this film kind of subverts tropes. It's another way the film just kind of cranks it up a little bit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think this film in the talking about cannibalism and things like that, it can often get, and I understand why, a lot of comparisons to kind of Texas Chainsaw Massacre with, you know, the consumerism, things like that we talked about in our episode on Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But I think what's important to note is that the main characters in this film, these group of men, they are not the outliers of society. They are not the quote-unquote hillbillies. They are the nation builders. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very important to keep that in mind. And the notion that, you know, not to get too much like M. Night Shyamalan's The Happening here, but that the Wendigo or something like that is an entity sent to kind of correct the wrongs that this Western expansion has done, that it's a nature kind of fighting back against this perceived God-given will to go expand.
Okay.
So there's so many heady things in this film.
Oh, my God. So many.
So many.
And I'm glad you brought up Martha, because that was something I was thinking about. It's another trope that this film subverts, in that there are these two indigenous characters in the film who provide this insight and this context into the Wendigo mythos, which is so central to the film. But that's about it. Which is so interesting when you consider how indigenous people are often depicted, usually in a racist manner, in films as some sort of missing link between civilization and savagery. This isn't what George and Martha are here for. Even just the fact that they are brother and sister and platonic. They're not like the couple and she's got the papoose and blah, blah, blah. I love that Ravenous avoids some of these really obvious racist trappings of presenting the Wendigo as something that would only afflict a believer, an indigenous person, like, to the threat of the civilized man.
Yeah, like Martha's basically rolling her eyes at these guys.
Right.
The whole film. Mm-hmm. Even when she's not on screen, which is unfortunately a lot of the film, sadly, you feel that eye roll.
That's right. And their knowledge of the Wendigo isn't eye roll superstition.
No.
It is central to what's going on. George and Martha are aware of this phenomenon, and they sort of help fight it to the extent that they can. But when the white men are cutting each other down, Martha gets the fuck out. And I would like to see more depictions like that. So on the heels of that, I mean, that's our Ravenous episode. I'm quite satisfied. I'm really glad that we covered this film. I was telling Alex before that it went from a film that I liked to a film that kind of puzzled me to a film that I can now confidently say that I love.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
We've unpacked all of its merits and everything, even its most bizarre elements, right down to the soundtrack. It makes sense now,
yeah,
having discussed it with you.
And, you know, it's refreshing to see an adult horror film. And by that, I just mean a film that is not centered around youth.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's also not centered around a family.
A family or a romantic intrigue.
Yeah.
It's a pretty asexual film apart from the homoeroticism.
It has all of these elements which we haven't totally seen before, and they all kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
And I constantly feel like even talking about it, I'm like, these elements shouldn't work, but they do.
Mm-hmm.
And just so credit to that entire fucking team for surviving a hellish production and creating something totally singular.
That's right.
And very exciting, and something that I know I'm going to be turning over this film in my mind for years to come.
Yeah. Once upon a time, I went to an independent film screening, and the filmmaker came up on stage and really arrogantly said that the film isn't going to do the work for you and you have to meet the film halfway. And I thought it was the most arrogant, pompous fucking shit that I'd ever heard. However, this film is one of those films that if you give in to its silliness and its sense of humor, and if you just accept the fact that there is very poignant satire within this black comedy, like, God, this film is so full of amazing one-liners.
Oh, yes.
The script is brilliant, and the finished product, insofar as it's a really maybe convoluted script with a lot of threads, they all tie up neatly and it all works beautifully the more you think about it.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
So, to wrap up, I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we enjoyed bringing it to you. For next month, we're going to go back in time a little bit. We're going to go a little bit classic. This was something we just kind of decided on the fly.
Yep.
But I'm excited to talk about it.
I'm very excited to talk about it, also because I hadn't realized you had seen it.
It's fairly recently that I've seen it, so this is going to be a fresh as fuck take.
And this is one of my like all-time favorites, and that is Georges Franju's Eyes Without a Face.
That is your March homework.
Yeah, check out the grandmother of New French Extremity.
Ooh.
And watch this fucking film.
Ah, it's going to be cool. I can't wait. But before we go, I have a quick confession to make, which
Andrew.
Is that in our annual assessment episode, I always share with you our blooper reel. And that is a file that I painstakingly keep all year long as I'm editing the podcast. If something remotely funny happens, it gets saved into a file and I dig into that file for the blooper reel for our assessment episode. I discovered, after publishing our assessment 2018 episode, that there are a whole bunch of bloopers that didn't make it into the final product. Without getting too technical, there was a break in the sound file, and when I copied and pasted it, it didn't all come over.
You know what? When can I hear these bloopers?
You can hear them right the fuck now. I'm going to tack them on to the end of this episode so you can enjoy them. There's a bunch more Dante. There's a bunch more belching. There's my amazing Gene Wilder impersonation.
Amazing is a strong word.
It's pretty good, man. You even said so.
Did I?
Yeah. I have it recorded. You can't deny it.
I'll believe it when I hear it.
But before we go, before I launch that blooper reel and we go on into our closing song, which I realize that I rarely talk about at the time of recording because I usually decide that when I'm editing with whatever I think fits.
Or when you text me.
Or when I text you for advice. I have been dying to close an episode with this song, and I was like, eventually we're going to tackle a film that pertains to Indigenous culture in some way, shape, or form. And insofar as this film does kind of tangentially, I think it fits. And so for the ending song for this episode, I'm going to close us out with a song by an Indigenous electronic group called A Tribe Called Red. And they are based out of Ottawa. my hometown, mm-hmm. and they've built their careers on fusing indigenous powwow drums and vocals with modern hip-hop and house music. And they're very political. They're super committed to being positive role models mm-hmm. for the indigenous Canadian community. And they're doing really awesome things on a feminist, anti-racist platform. So I'm really proud to close out with a track by them. And I'll link that album in the show notes so you can hear more. And I hope you enjoy it.
Yeah, Tribe Called Red are super fucking cool. Mm-hmm. If you like what they do, you might also want to check out an artist by the name of Tanya Tagok. We'll link her in the show notes as well. She's also an indigenous musician, and she specializes in kind of throat singing, which is a tradition from indigenous culture, and then fusing it with modern music. And it is beautiful and incredible and just, fuck, it's so fucking good.
I need more indigenous horror, guys.
Yes.
But until next time.
Office hours are closed.
Yes, we will link it to it. We will link to it in our fuck off. Fine, I won't even say that. You win. Cheating bitch. Where do you want to, what?
Dark impersonal antagonists and a refusion of true catharsis.
Holy shit.
Which, holy shit, is that this movie?
Refusion?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah, this movie is...
A refusal.
Yeah. Is it refusal?
Should I take that again?
Yeah.
So, I think so.
Okay. What in the fuck was that? What was that?
I don't know.
It sounded like a colossal fart. Like, yeah. The likes of which could not have come from this dog. What did you... Oh, did you hit this thing?
Did you hit the stopper?
And I think that's important to note because the subtitle to this film is that it's a New England fairy tale.
Folktale.
Fuck. I knew I was going to fuck that up.
I like how you just looked at me as you were saying.
Correct me if I'm wrong, and you did.
The body of a young unidentified woman is found at the brutal... The body of a young... Jesus Christ, I'm sorry.
We're fed up of covering up for sexual predators, and we want them to pay. We want them to suffer the social sig... The blah, blah.
Look at my hot air balloon-shaped booty.
Sachet away.
There was an extra scene with Weir meeting with an admirable. Smith was kind of in this original strip... in this version of the strip... Oh, my God. Mad, bad, and dangerous.
I know.
Sounds like a list of my ex-boyfriends.
He had British actors, he had American actors, he had a New Zealand actor in Sam Weir. he works for CERN, and that is Center for European... And, you know, to go back to someone who I also mentioned in the Event Horizon portion of this episode, Einstein... I was actually quite shocked to read.
Wow. Oh, twins.
Oftentimes, in the most controversial, popular, exciting stories that we have told ourselves and audiences around the world. Or that burp. And so I think it'd be a good time to bring up the theme of deinstitutionalization. The reality of the world seeping in, just as we talked about in Teeping Palm.
Wow. Hot.
But.
Nice. Gotcha.
God damn it.
But the roots are there, and they will seed and grow. Punctuate it.
Andrea, what are we talking about next month?
I truly forget. That's it for this.
So check out your peephole. Check out our peephole. We're going looking through our peephole.
And I want to go into Goffman, but I need a beer. What's up?
Yeah, I could.
Yeah? Can I pause this and get a beer?
Yeah. Okay, let's
do it. Do it now.
And what's interesting about Hunger Games, it was used to subvert the power of Hitler as he was ascending to power. It was used to mock Hitler
That was a sneeze.
I think a film like Scary Movie.
So sorry.
It's totally fine.
Okay.
So there's even more.
Dustin's home. You know, I like satire a lark. Academy Award winner for Best Adapted Screenplay for Mel Brooks and Gene Wilder. This is Young...
Was nominated.
Fuck. What?
Didn't win.
I thought they did win. I had that... Oh, I had that wrong.
Are you trying to die to Dada? Oh, God! This is my Gene Wilder impression!
That's actually good!
I haven't practiced it, but it wasn't bad.
That was good! After a mix-up with the brain meant to be used in the body, After a mix-up with the brain meant to be used in the body of Frankenstein's monster,
Frankenstein!
God, I'm confusing my fucking self with this. After a mix-up with the brain meant to be used in the body of the new monster, the monster is brought back to life, but... Huh.
Oh, wow.
I wrote this in a fucking meeting.
We are the Halusa Nation. Our DNA is of earth and sky.
Suckers allowed to break bread or asunder. The daylight, lightning, and the thunder. Sun, moon, and stars, and the hunger. Abundance in bundles, blessings in troubles. Towers and tunnels, views and valleys, waves and peaks. Streets you from sun, planet Earth. And ain't scared of no Mars attack. What type of bars is that? Stay off my chat. I'm out there calling riot garments. Top five diet on and on them. Superfly slicker top bro. Eagles diving on them. You why you lying, homie? You won't play with my emotions, Smokey. Big chief heart rate, big beat, B-E-Y-I seen straight jacket come clean. Big said it was a dream. Now it's a living thing. With you and living kings, I mean it, I mean.
Confronted by the Ally Nation, Alien Nation, the subjects and the citizens see the material religions through trauma and numb. Nothing is related. All the things of the earth and in the sky have energy to be exploited. Even themselves, mining their spirits into souls sold. Into nothing is sacred, not even their self. The Ally Nation, Alien Nation.
Watch the banner burn before the cannon burst. Don't chase an illusion, the nation hallucin. Hallelujah, taste of the future. The people that shower, the piss of the coward that tracing the suture. Lonely martyrs, magic carpets, dirty blankets, Coca-Cola, soul controller, holy waters. Middle East mode, sand glorious, cheat code in Babylonian, the Orient. My superhero got the people power. Yassin and Yassin, you should heed the hour.
When you and living kings, I mean it, I mean. Solid with